You can change, you can change, you can change.
I'd start with those shoes.
Still, queer as folk. Tonight, Emmett sees the light and goes straight. And Michael redecorates Dr. David's architecturally perfect mid-century modern house. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
This is episode 12 of season 1, and it's called Move It or Lose It.
I like to move it, lose it. It first aired on Showtime in the U.S. on March 4th, 2001.
It was directed by John Grayson, his second of four Queer as Folk episodes that he directed. We talked about John Grayson in episode 9, Daddy Dearest Sonny Boy, if you want to know a little bit more about him. Move It or Lose It was written by Richard Kramer, Ron Cohen, and Daniel Lipman. We've tended to like Richard Kramer penned episodes. Not so much with showrunners Ron Cohen and Daniel Lipman, though, so we'll see what this one has to offer.
For the synopsis from IMDb, Michael and Dr. David enjoy their newfound domestic bliss. Emmett joins a conversion therapy group.
See the light.
Lindsay and Melanie continue to fight about Brian, finances, and their future.
Lesbian bed death.
And Ted becomes very sexually active. For the Showtime synopsis, Brian tries, without success, to replace Michael's friendship. Does he ever?
It sounds very clinical. Let me replace the button on my jacket.
While Michael faces problems with his move-in, upon his move-in with David, and Emmett attends a meeting for those wishing to convert from gay to straight lifestyles.
Do you see the light?
I hated that they named that character Matt. I was so angry. I claim no responsibility for this Matt.
This episode had some interesting themes to it.
Yeah, I see in your notes you described it. It had the feel of another bridge of more things to come, because it really felt like it was part two of episode 11, especially with how it opens, because it's Brian in his apartment running where his treadmill, and this is always bothering me, his treadmill is just kind of like in the middle of the room.
Yeah. But he's, well, where else would you run on the treadmill?
And
he only has one room.
Yeah. And it's the loft. It's so interesting. He's running in front of the pictures of Michael from the party.
Mm-hmm.
So I found that had some significance.
He left those up. Yeah. This episode was lacking a lot in drama that we've seen in the past episodes. So there's things like Justin and his parents. That was a pretty deep theme that was going on before. That's nowhere to be found in this episode.
Yeah, where is Jennifer? I miss one of my favorite characters. She's now been gone, what, two episodes?
Yeah, she's got to come back. This one just came across as like a sitcom. It was story-driven, but there weren't really any big gay lessons from it. In the last episode, we had the big gay HIV lesson. Here, there's not a whole bunch of wisdom that we're seeing in it. So while Brian's running.
While Brian is running to nowhere in front of pictures of Michael, Michael and Emmett are in their apartment, and Michael is packing, and he is moving in with Dr. David Cameron, and I am so...
Oh.
I don't know how I feel about it.
It's your dream scenario. To move in with your chiropractor.
Yeah, and I kind of want Michael to get out of the way so I can.
I did like that Brian dials Michael and then hangs up. And that's something that Michael did in the last episode. He called Dr. David and hung up on him. So what is all this, like, let's call our friends and hang up on them, knowing full well who they were.
And notice that Michael apparently, I guess, doesn't pay for caller ID, but he can recognize that it's Brian through apparently a slightly deviated septum of some sort.
Who was that?
Brian.
And what did he have to say?
He didn't say anything. He just hung up.
So how do you know it was him?
His breathing. He's got this funny little wheeze from his deviated septum.
It's not the only thing about him that's deviated.
So, at Michael and Emmett's flat, there's a funny costume thing there that I noted, that Michael's wearing a sleeveless shirt for the first time. And I thought that was pretty funny. He was almost... like the customers were trying to gay him up just for this one scene. Or maybe that's what we...
It's not gay enough that he's moving in with another man?
Yeah, maybe that's what you wear around the house, right?
Sure.
What was the line where, I don't know what the lead-in was, but I just wrote down that Michael came back with, I preferred the term domestic partner.
Yeah, Emmett described, I think he's really, like, he described Dr. David Cameron as his boyfriend or something, and he I prefer the term. Oh, he said something about his, like, him being his husband, I think is what he said.
Whoever would have believed, you, a married lady.
I prefer the term domestic partner.
It's interesting that that term is now out of favor because you don't have to be a domestic partner anymore. You can be the husband.
You can be the husband. You can be the wife. You can be the whatever. It's great.
There was this cute moment between Michael and Emmett when they were saying goodbye to each other. Emmett says,
good luck, sweetie. And remember, you always have a place to come back to.
And it was just so cute.
And then Michael attacks him with his giant Captain Astro cardboard cutout.
The fist. He's coming at him with the fist, and Emmett says,
Captain Astro uses his magical fisting power.
Quit it. It's too early for fisting.
Oh, it's never too early for fisting.
And I would agree with that. I think the morning is always too early for fisting.
Well, and Emmett's given up sex at this point, so I don't know why he's thinking about fisting right there.
That is very true.
It's a work day, apparently. I don't know why Michael isn't at the big queue and Emmett's not at Torso, but Brian's at work and he's with Cynthia, his assistant, and they're smoking in Brian's office. Could you smoke in an office in 2001?
Part of me thinks that they just didn't care.
Yeah, that's probably true because Brian told everybody to fuck off at that moment, including his boss.
Yeah, and remember he's also banged clients in the public bathroom.
True.
So smoke, why not?
He had a call from his gym, his tailor, and his boss. Well, first of all, your gym never calls you. They don't want to talk to you.
No.
They just want you to keep paying and pretend that you go there every day. They're not going to call and remind you to go.
Oh, absolutely not.
Taylor, I can see. You know, your tailor will call you and say, your pants are ready. Your boss definitely, like, wears this or that. But Brian's just, fuck the gym, fuck the tailor, and fuck my boss. It's like,
I wonder if he has.
Jeez, I don't think he fucked this boss. And Cynthia, his assistant, starts talking about how for the past week there have been no phone calls from Michael every 5 minutes.
That's excessive.
Do they ever get any work done?
No, because again, Michael is too busy Brian is too busy banging all the clients.
Well, and Michael is on the floor of the big queue, so that was implausible. I see what they're trying to do with those lines, but it just couldn't possibly have happened. And we never heard of that kind of attachment before. We had seen phone calls between everybody, but
we've seen the party lines happening. But yeah, to describe it as that, I mean, I'm sure she's exaggerating, but even then I haven't seen that, so
right,
where
right.
did it come from?
Meanwhile, Ted is just walking down Liberty Avenue. Everybody seems to be out of time and place here. Brian seems to be the only one at work. Ted, you would think, would be at work, or at least in his work clothes, but he's not. He's in casual clothes, and he's just wandering down Liberty Avenue.
He might have taken a PTO day. It's fine.
A me day.
Yeah.
So we get our favorite split screen again. Every time there's a phone call between two people, it's kind of the old style split screen. One person on one side, the other person on the other, or in the party line, there's four or five people. And Ted is talking to Brian, which generally doesn't happen, as we find out. So it's time to go to the gym. I guess work can wait, or work is over.
Yeah, and it's Ted and Emmett doing some back exercises, it looks like.
Emmett was working his butt, as he's always doing in the gym.
Right, because how else is he going to attract someone like Beau?
Beau, French for beautiful. As Ted told us.
It's very subtle, Ted.
Ted had this really good line after Emmett turned down Beau, where he said,
are you out of your mind? Guys like us do not turn down guys like him. You have acted in flagrant violation of the entire gay social structure.
I like the flagrant violation part.
Oh, that was so fantastic. Because Bo is like being very forward, and it got to the point where it was just a little stalkerish. And he's like, oh yeah, because you go to the same dentist, and I see. I was like, oh no, you have followed me around a little too much, Bo, as attractive as you are.
Yeah, and up until now, until Emmett made his promise with God to never have sex with men again if he turns out negative in the last episode. Ordinarily, he would take Bo and allow Bo to bend him over the weight bench. And
right, and he's already at position.
But Emmett really is still has his HIV testing weekend fresh in his head, and he's a little afraid to re-engage on it because he doesn't want to go through that again. He doesn't want to have to deal with that again. So he's overcompensating about something that ultimately worked out okay in the end.
His fear of sex, because of a scare that, again, his health was never, in fact, in question.
Yeah.
I've been trying to figure out why he would have such a 180 reaction to sex.
It can be quite a thing if you have that HIV scare. I've seen people do this before where they have that scare moment, and I say scare in air quotes because it's by no means the death sentence that it used to be. But I've seen people react over the top to that and kind of overcompensate for it. It doesn't last for very long, but it's still present, and people just don't want to be into that particular frame of mind again. So they say, I'm going to eliminate the one thing that put me into that frame of mind. And in Emmett's case, it's sex with hot men.
But what's troubling me is that we know that, like, it wasn't even that he had a fear of him being positive and it turned out negative. It was that that was never even a question at all. And we know that, and they described in the previous episode, the amount of sexual prevention that he does.
Right. Yeah, he was overreacting.
I'm surprised no one said, Emmett, you should probably go talk to someone. You should probably go to a counselor if this is what you're feeling. Because he should not have to fear sex.
In the entirety of Queer as Folk, did anybody ever go to a psychiatrist or a psychologist to work on their problems?
Lindsay.
Did they?
Yes, within the first few episodes. And Mel mentions that she's been in therapy for like 5 years. I think she mentioned that in the last episode.
Oh, yeah.
Episode.
Well, and Justin did too with his mother.
It's just all of our other characters who desperately need it.
Yeah. Speaking of Mel and Lindsay, there's a quick lesbian interlude that happens here. Melanie comes home from work exhausted and catty and kind of looking to pick a fight with Lindsay. And she goes right to the bar in the house and she grabs a whiskey and they start just bitching about nothing.
Yeah. And I'm telling you, I really think that Mel may have a drinking problem. Because
we're going to have to start tracking this and keep an eye on her. Well, she's in trouble. We need an intervention.
It's gone ever since the first time we met Dr. David Cameron met them, and she drunkenly thought he was with Brian and didn't know that he was with Michael.
At the Gay and Lesbian Center.
Right. And then we have Michael's birthday party where she made an ass of herself.
Doing shots with Justin, smoking cigarettes.
And now coming home from, I'm sure it was a long and hard day at work because she's doing double the work to make up for the fact that Lindsay is able to now stay home. And what does she do? She goes right to the carafe of whiskey and pours it into her tumbler. Like she's Craig Taylor.
Oh, good association there. I didn't even think of that one. This scene was pretty short, though. Other action is happening at Woody's, and there's a Michael and Ted juxtaposition through the eyes of Brian.
But is there really action happening? Because they come to this bar, and they don't even have anything to say to one another, because it seems like this is a pairing that has not happened.
Yeah. And that's why I liked the quick cuts to where you think that Brian's talking to Ted, but then there's Michael in the picture, and then it's back to Ted. And so you're going from excitement to...
Right. How was work? And all Ted has to say
he's got nothing.
It was boring.
Yeah.
And then this shirtless man walks in and... into the conversation and wants to hit on Brian. And Brian says, I'm not interested. And out of nowhere, Ted is looking at the man and he's like, he decides to make one little quip, and it seems that it then becomes a sort of revenge lay for both Ted and the trick.
Yeah.
Because they both also make sure they throw darts at Brian that, oh, you're not going to flirt with me? Well, I'm going to flirt with him.
Well, he did need financial advice.
That's true. I mean, two birds, one stone.
Well, I tell you what. You help me diversify my portfolio, I'll help diversify yours.
Go, Ted. So it wouldn't be an episode without stopping by Dr. David's architecturally perfect mid-century modern home.
Well, it's an important moment because Michael is moving in and he's brought in all of his boxes. Now, him moving in and what we know of Michael, majority of his, let's say, collections, is how would that really flow with the very purposefully designed...
architecturally perfect mid-century modern home.
Of Dr. David Cameron.
But before they resolve that issue, they've got to fuck. Let's head to the bedroom.
Let's talk about these sex scenes. So I really loved the juxtaposition between what was going on with Michael and the sex he's having with Dr. David Cameron and the interaction that Brian has outside of Woody's. So Ted and Trick goes off to do their thing.
Wherever they go.
Yeah, and Brian looks to his left, and then there's someone by an alleyway who gives him a head nod, and they go off to the alley, where apparently this is an alley in which multiple people hook up.
This looked like a dungeon. There's like gates and bars and
also
mood lighting.
It was chilly outside. Yes, because I was seeing a lot of like steam and like people's their breath. And I'm like, you're really going to get a blowjob in this alley when it's probably like, what, mid-November?
You know, that's now that you mentioned that, that's something interesting about Queer as Folk is that they were always shooting in the non-summer seasons. It was always cold. They shot in Toronto, but it warms up in Toronto. And these days you can't have a gay show without it being in the summer, without naked or scantily clad, Speedo-wearing people cavorting around. It's almost like the two have become so connected to each other that you can't do a gay show without that. And yet Queer as Folk always was shooting in these off-seasons where people are wearing winter coats and scarves and things like that.
They were layered.
Yeah, there's just very few gratuitous outdoor sexy scenes.
Unless you go out to the country with Dr. David Cameron.
And that's true. It wasn't cold. Maybe it was cold. They had to heat it up.
But yeah, so Brian is having this very, like, literally trashy hookup because they're by a dumpster. And
Michael
is having this passionate lovemaking session with Dr. David Cameron. I mean, it was very erotically charged.
I imagined you watching the scene with some tissues because there's all these shots of Dr. David's ass as he's aggressively topping Michael.
And it's perfect, obviously.
There was an interesting way that it was being cut together because you have the grittiness of Pittsburgh alleyway in winter combined with the dreamy Dr. David's bedroom.
In his architecturally perfect mid-century home.
That's right. And the duality of Michael and his lover and Brian with an anonymous trick pointed out something that really had always been there for Brian, but was new to Michael. Because normally he'd be waiting for Brian to cop off in the alley before driving him home. And there's a super cliche and expected moment where Brian kind of staggers out of the alley after blowing his load all over that trick and just I read into that a little bit and just says, Mikey. And of course, Mikey's not there.
Right. And because they had this, Michael explained that he normally would be waiting in the Jeep.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, he's there with Dr. David Cameron.
In love.
And then within 2 seconds, Brian is coming out of that alleyway and going, Mikey.
Yeah.
And seeing nothing there.
I did like the music in this scene, though. It was by Tin Star, which was a British electro band in the late 90s. They had kind of a New Order sound. And I just gave up looking at the streaming versions of this because I'm tired of having the season ruined by overdubs of generic stock music. So I just wanted to give a call out to Tin Star there. Good morning, Dr. David's architecturally perfect mid-century modern home.
He comes around the corner. Dr. David Cameron is in a very well-fitting t-shirt.
I think Brian was, or Brian, I think Michael was shirtless with like sweatpants.
Yes. And he's unpacking and
he took over that room. It's like, that's the only room that he was decorating or something, but he completely conquered that room with all of his belongings.
I was a little bit in shock with just how much of his stuff he threw out in that living room. Like, I understand maybe having a display case.
Yeah.
Sure. But to literally put everything you own all over that obviously very carefully designed living room, I can understand why Dr. David Cameron was taken aback a little bit by it.
It was honestly very garish and
awful. Argument from this corner.
But this scene was a little dumb, I thought, because they should be redecorating together. I think Dr. David should have been taking more of a leadership role, since it was his house, into kind of guiding that. Michael should have known better than to just start sticking all of his toys into whatever nook and cranny he could find everywhere. That's something that you do together when you move in with your husband
or remember, chiropractor. This is the first time Michael has ever experienced anything like this. So when Dr. David Cameron says, this is your home now too, he took that very literally.
And ran with it.
Oh my God. I mean, I liked the moment where he explained why he was going to go to work on a Saturday and that, you know.
Not stay and watch the game.
Which I was like.
Game? What game?
What sports event would Dr. David Cameron be watching?
It was hockey, actually. It was hockey,
yes.
This did complement nicely the lesbian interlude, because we go from Michael and Dr. David being awkward together in their house to Mel and Lindsay doing chores on a Saturday.
And the way this was shot, like them doing the chores, it was very aggressive.
Yeah.
with the vacuuming coming like right up to the camera, with the cleaning of the table, mm-hmm. the polishing of the table coming right up to the camera.
Is it like passive aggressive housekeeping?
Oh yeah. It was like clearly like, oh, they both have things to say to one another and they're not saying it. So they're going to take it out on the chores.
Yeah. Take it out on that rug. Melanie had that funny line when Brian showed up where she said,
oh my God,
she said,
I didn't know you're into bears. I thought you preferred the young, hairless, not admitted without a parent or guardian type.
I died when she said that. I was cackling in my living room. I'm pretty sure I woke up neighbors when I heard that. It was so funny. Especially considering that the teddy bear he brought for Gus is a bear that's in leather gear.
I love that teddy bear. I wanted to find one.
I thought it was hilarious, but I'm also like, you're going to use that to entertain your infant child. That's great.
And Brian just casually says, I thought I'd drop by for dinner, which I'm sure has never once happened in the history of Brian, Melanie, and Lindsay. And so it left me wondering, did Brian's entire life fall apart after his little spat with Michael?
Yes.
But I find that hard to believe. That is out of character for Brian Kinney.
No, it's that symbiotic relationship. Now that they don't have the ability to feed on one another.
But Brian is almost omnipotent. It just seems unlike the character to fall apart. I like that the writers had to give some vulnerability to the character. But I didn't like that it was just so overdone. Brian essentially became a shadow of himself without Michael. And I just don't see is that a character as strong as Brian Kinney would fall apart quite so much.
It's probably also tied to how their falling out occurred, because Brian took it to such an extreme and did incredibly hurtful things that, do you think it's possible that he feels any guilt?
Yeah, that's fair. I don't know. The scene was not tracking well with me, and I never really nailed why, other than I didn't like seeing Brian in that state. I like seeing Brian as the arrogant, egotistical, cocky, know-it-all swagger. But also, did Melanie and Lindsay forget how pissed they were at Brian after the party? They just sort of welcome him right in.
I don't know if they welcomed him.
They let him in.
Well, I don't know if they even really let him in. She opened the door and there he was. And it's like, what do you do with this now?
But, I mean, they've chased him away before when he would show up at the door like drunk or you know, something like that. Like in Sunny Boy, he came over a little bit tipsy.
Well, he's also using the fact that he's there to talk with Gus or to play with Gus. So yeah. If you have a child in play.
It's like he's just making the rounds, just looking for something to do.
Or what, right, because again, his life is literally empty without Michael.
He's looking for whatever comes his way.
Oh my gosh.
My favorite Grindr saying.
But now we are...
Whatever happened to Tracy?
Well, again, Michael is coming to work on a Saturday, and Miss Sassy Mouth, I keep forgetting her name.
Marley
is reading something that she picked up of the internet, which is, how do you know if your husband is gay?
And she printed it also. Oh,
she printed it and to share with the rest of the big Q workers.
She's a hoot.
She is, as homophobic as I think she is. And she's reading this list and she thinks it's hilarious. And Michael walks up and is sort of hearing it too. Tracy is recognizing Michael's face and what he's feeling hearing this. And Tracy steps up and is like, I have a lot of problems with this.
Yeah, she owned that scene. She owned Michael and she quit. She told Mr. Novotny that she got a job at the Big Dollar Mart.
It's like, what are these stores?
The Big Q, the Big Dollar Mart, Bob Barbarossa's empire.
I think the writers of this episode are size queens.
That is one thing about Queer as Folk writing that always got my attention is some of the esoteric minutiae of the show is often poorly thought out. Remember the names of those two girls that Chris Hobbs was mounting? It was just these stupid names that they came up with that stand out. I've seen the writers in Queer as Folk do this over and over and over where they just have not put a lot of thought into it. The Big Dollar Mart, the Big Q. I mean, it's just weak. They didn't show that they were there when they wrote those lines. They just kind of typed whatever came out of their fingers.
There was no editing in that writing room.
Yeah.
Well, so now it's the evening and we're back at Woody's and it seems Brian is giving another college try to hanging out with Ted, even though it was.
Why was Brian not interested in any of these tricks? So remember, they're all coming up and Brian says, no, not interested. I'm not interested. I'm not interested. Why not? Did he lose his mojo because Michael was gone? Is he unable to pick up some guy without Michael around? I didn't see what was going on there. This
is
a fascinating
question. Yeah, why would is it the guilt that he's feeling? Is
well, he got off in the alley the night before. So what's different about this?
It's almost like he begrudgingly got off in the alley. You know, it was like well, it was like that blowjob was the one that like drained him, and now he just doesn't have anything left.
That can happen.
But Ted is reaping the benefits of all this.
Go, Ted.
Good for Ted.
I love how Ted was checking up on
after Blake team. Drugged you, you deserve this.
After
you go,
barebacking
Ted.
In the back of a Jeep. Have I ever told you, Matt, how much I love the overall arc of Ted throughout the entire series? We try not to foreshadow too much. But
I know, because I adore Ted and I know where things go with him, he's a character that's very near and dear to me. So I think we definitely share that.
I can't wait until we get deeper into the series and are talking about some of Ted's more.
Oh, he goes through.
We'll
so
call
much.
Them dramatic moments.
At Woody's, and separate from the group, from the other two, is Emmett, who is
drunk.
Ooh, a little too many flirtinis, I think, were happening. And this guy comes up to him in this very large winter coat.
That yellow jacket.
Oh, my God. Yeah. And he introduces himself to Emmett. Says
there was something strange about this guy. The minute we see him, wait a minute.
It was a little too serial killer calm when he introduced himself.
Well, and he was costumed in a way that made him stand out. That yellow jacket was like...
That he was keeping on in the bar.
Yeah, it was like a high visibility vest for working alongside the railroad. He had to make sure that he just did not match up with anybody in there. But right. You get a taste that, wait a minute, what is this guy? What's going on here?
And he introduces himself, says his name is Matt. I don't claim any any similarity or likeness to this Matt.
Oh, Matt.
And Matt
has seen the light.
Has seen the light. And it looks like he goes on a walk with coffee with Emmett.
Oh, yeah. I guess he was like going to sober Emmett up. And so they leave the bar. Then they have coffee cups and it's like broad daylight outside.
I think it was the next day.
Think so?
I think it had to be the next day.
Well, Matt was wearing the same jacket, his high-vis jacket.
He wears the same jacket in all of his scenes.
Does he really?
Yes. And I thought that was weird. He's wearing the jacket when he's on that coffee walk with Emmett. He's wearing the jacket when he takes Emmett to the first meeting with See the Light. And I'm like, I feel like the jacket is a source of power for him or something.
It's his magic cloak.
Yes. You take that off and you disarm him.
I could see that. He was attractive in that sort of mysterious
culty way.
Yeah. Serial killer way.
Everyone's welcome in this group. And it's all people like us.
Like us?
People who are questioning and evaluating. Why don't you come to one of our meetings? All you've got to lose is your pain.
We're about halfway through the episode here, and this is the first time that we see Justin, which is a little unusual. Normally he makes an appearance earlier in the episode.
But he's hard at work at the diner.
Oh, yeah. Daphne's in the diner doing her homework, which is something new.
And what does it say on Justin's shirt?
Oh, it was French Connection UK, so it said...
I think I'm too busy to FC UK.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's
I think
great.
Someplace I still have a couple of French Connection UK shirts.
Maybe we should auction them off to one of our listeners.
That would probably be the pitcher and catcher shirts that I have also.
Oh my God. With the twins.
The Todds.
Oh, the Todds.
Justin has this funny line to Daphne where he says,
I could fuck practically anyone I wanted.
He was so cocky and self-assured there. I love that. And then Brian comes in, and I also loved how Justin was so surprised by Brian's attention. Justin said, do you realize this is the first time he's ever asked me to come over? But it's not. He has been invited over there countless times for hot bottoming.
But it feels like this is the first time where we see Brian making such a very clear distinction that I want you to come over to my place.
What, do you think the other ones were just sort of casual pickups?
Well, no. Every other time that we've seen it happen, it's come out of a need for something like... or he's played around with him, or he's played around with his emotions.
Kind of manipulated him into chasing him, not being invited.
Right. Here it's a very clear indication that it's you, me, my place now.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't bother finishing your shift. Cash out now and let's go.
What then happens is Brian has ordered a sandwich and then Michael has entered. And they're both, one's at the register, one's at the counter.
Michael orders his lemon squares.
And
those look good. Did you see the lemon squares? Oh my God. Debbie, make us some.
What I liked about this moment, though, is I think Justin is proving himself to be incredibly savvy to the situation. So he clearly understands why Brian has invited him over. That he is really just the consolation prize or the object in which Brian can stave off some boredom.
Yeah. Michael did have that weird line to Justin when he walked in. He says,
hey, boy wonder, a couple of lemon squares to go.
That was out of place. Michael never greets Justin that way. He typically greets him with disdain and dislikes him at that first initial sentence. So I thought the boy wonder
was a mocking thing because he knows that Justin is sticking his nose in his business. And we know that how Michael feels about that, especially with him living with his mother and sleeping in his bedroom.
Well, speaking of sleeping in bedrooms, let's check in at Dr. David's architecturally perfect mid-century modern house.
So Michael returns and notices that a few of his things are missing.
All of them.
Literally everything. To be fair, Michael's shit really clashed with Dr. David Cameron's beautifully architectured.
But I think, again, if they would have done it together, they could have come up with something that works.
There totally could have been compromises.
This passive aggressive decorating is weird. It's like, I'm going to decorate as a weapon.
and I did find that moment when Michael looked in the closet and found Captain Astro in the closet.
Yeah.
I found that kind of funny.
Dr. David got very bossy, and
I really did not like how he described what it was like to have Michael's items all over his house.
Well, before that, he said the wrong thing to Michael, which was,
hey, well, one good thing came out of what Brian did. It made you realize that you belong here with me. Take off your jacket. Get ready for dinner.
That's
a little possessive.
Yeah, I heard that line and I was like, oh, Michael, what are you in for here?
That's if I'm going to find a flaw in Dr. David Cameron, it's that he feels that he has some sort of ownership of Michael.
Mm-hmm. He wasn't fighting for his attention anymore. It was like he realized that he won. He had Michael in the house, and it's like, put the lotion in the basket.
Oh, God.
It wasn't quite that bad, but it just rang different for the Dr. David-Michael dynamic. Up until that point, Dr. David was like fighting to get him, and now that he's got him, he's making the most of it and really, really, really leveraging that you live in my house, boy, type of thing. God.
I'm glad that Michael, he found a way to stand his ground. He said, like, you told me that this place was mine too. This stuff may seem like they're toys, but they have an emotional value to me.
Yeah, I did like that.
And I wish you would recognize that.
Wait a minute. For once, Michael stands up for himself.
I know, right? I feel like it's...
Yeah,
this is a turning point for Michael.
He had that speech in his back pocket and ready to just deliver it to somebody.
Boom. And it was, I mean, what a time to deliver it. It was great.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it really resonated with Dr. David Cameron.
Yeah. Meanwhile, this scene in Brian's loft, I watched it a couple times.
I'm sure you did.
Sorry.
All I could think was Brian is such trash because he's drinking, again, Jim Beam from the bottle while Justin is in his lap. They're both naked on a modern chaise lounge.
The Le Corbusier, yes. Chaise lounge.
And I can't get over that Brian is downing Jim Beam from the bottle
while eating ice cream. I thought this scene was hot. I loved that connection between them and that comfort.
I was into the ice cream bit, but it's when Justin sort of tries to nudge Brian about Michael and then he hits the bottle that I'm like, okay.
Maybe it could have gone without it. There was one line where Justin says that his mother doesn't completely hate this Brian, but since when? The last time we saw Jennifer Taylor was where she had organized the summit at the Taylor family estate.
The summit.
With Craig and Brian, and they all stomped out, and Jennifer wasn't entirely on Justin's side there. But I think
the ultimatum that Craig decided to impose probably put Jennifer more in Brian's corner.
Well, remember, Jennifer, he's not a boy.
He's a man.
So that remark seems slightly out of context there, but I forgot about that one pretty quickly because there's this amazing view of Justin's butt in that scene. And we get an underwear check of Justin. He's wearing very big gray briefs, but nevertheless, I'm fine with that.
He fills them out well.
Yeah, and Brian is all but confiding to Justin that he pushed Michael away on purpose, and that was a powerful thing for Brian to be saying to Justin. He was starting to see Justin as somebody that he can trust with some of these really deep feelings, so I like that line.
So you pushed him away. That was the only course of action. Yeah, but now he hates you.
It's okay. As long as Mikey's happy.
And then Justin has this line where he says, you can't push me away. I'm on to you. And Brian just kind of eats that one. He knows that Justin's figured it out, and Justin's taking off. I don't know where he's going or why he left, but
also, what were with those pants that he put on?
Oh yeah,
these were like heavy cargo pants of some sort. Like he was Sporty Spice or something. It was.
Or in TLC, standing on a pier in the water.
but as he's leaving, he nabs the Captain Astro number one.
He stole it. Like, Brian wasn't going to notice that it was missing.
He's such a thief.
But he was doing it for the right reasons. That's so very true. It gets a pass. It's not like he committed a felony by, you know, charging a credit card across state lines and fleeing to New York or anything. This was just petty theft. So, it's time to see the light.
Our first speaker tonight is Ginger, and she was formerly in the dark, but now she's seen the light.
This scene at the gay conversion center, or wherever this was, I don't know how I felt about this, other than a guy that I dated for a very long time. His parents did try to get him to see the light when he was younger, and they did send him to like a conversion therapy thing, and he finally escaped it, and everything worked out in the end. But as soon as I started watching the scene, I was like, ooh, this whole thing just was, but I did find the comedy in it. So,
well, like, yeah, because Emmett is sitting here going like, is this for real? And he is like, he is reading each person talking, mm-hmm. and I'm here for it. It's great.
Yeah, that part about where the stereotypical lesbian says, oh, I used to be a lesbian. And Emmett just kind of leans over to Matt and says, used to be?
Or the mantra that this group has, you can change, you can change,
you can change.
You can change, you can change, you can change.
I'd start with those shoes.
Ty. I love Ty and Ginger, the leaders of the
most homosexual, heterosexual couple you could possibly run into. It harkens back to in the original Will and Grace series, where Neil Patrick Harris played a man who was also running such a group. Jack and Karen joined so Jack could try and get with him, but they pose as a formerly gay but now heterosexual couple.
There's some good stuff with this arc. It struck a nerve for me, but I like the humor in it, and I was able to kind of get past the like forebodingness of the whole conversion thing and just kind of enjoy the scene and where it was headed.
But because Ty catches on to some of the better reads that Emmett has been throwing at the group, he then goes into this meticulous breakdown of what gay culture is like.
Do you and your friends obsess about your bodies and the bodies of other men?
Check out his pecs. They're like perfect. They're like implants.
Do your conversations center around trivialities, such as movie stars?
Did you hear that Cher had her pussy tightened?
Where'd you read that? The Inquirer or Popular Mechanics?
Are your days and nights spent at the gym and in bars? Going home with men whose names you don't even know?
So he's coming, and he's going, Fred, 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 who's Fred?
So, maybe you should ask yourself, is this the life I want for me?
It was very spot on.
I sat there going like, you're not wrong.
All the things we hold dear.
But whereas he saw it as a negative and used it against Emmett, for Emmett to then, quote unquote, see the light.
Yeah. Did Emmett? I don't think Emmett had quite seen the light in this first session.
But it certainly made him think. Because he realized that, that everything Ty just described is exactly what he does or has experienced.
He definitely saw the light heading his way.
It's like Carol Ann and Poltergeist. Come toward the light.
Before we have another lesbian interlude, back at the architecturally perfect mid-century modern home, Michael's stuff, according to Dr. David, sort of doesn't belong there. And I couldn't think of anything meaner for Dr. David to have said to him. Even if he didn't like that stuff, that was just cruel. It was a very cutting and biting thing to say. And it was only going to make Michael think that he was just another piece of the furniture there, that his own belongings didn't belong in the house. Only his cute little bubble butt did.
That's the only thing that needed to be on a shelf, apparently. This shows a very strong flaw in Dr. David Cameron, that he has to have a lot of control.
He wants it his way.
Yeah, and that's it.
So let's rush over to the lesbian interlude, if we must.
I think you're a little over the lesbians right now, Patrick.
I just think they're some of the weakest scenes that we get so far. I think you had talked about in a previous podcast that they almost have to fit them in pro forma in order to check the box each episode, and they don't think as much as they need to in the scenes. It gets better as we go, but for now they're kind of shallow all the time.
We open the door. Mel opens the door, and Ted is there sweating and panting.
He ran all the way from Liberty Avenue
to the house because it was an emergency. And Mel is like, yes, it is an emergency.
Can't talk about it on the phone.
It is an emergency. Get him out of here. And it's Brian using Leather Bear to play with Gus. And Mel is at her wit's end because he keeps coming back.
Ted does secure Brian's departure. We start to see that Melanie and Lindsay are falling apart, and there was some good cinematography here where the scene was playing out between the two, and there was two alternating shots between Melanie and Lindsay that were visually separating them, and they were pull-away shots again. Pull-away shots where the camera is backing up, and you're seen a little bit more of the environment that the actor's in. They become a smaller part of the shot. And these were alternating back and forth between Melanie and Lindsay, and it really, really worked well to show them separating and starting to come unraveled at the scene. I really liked the visuals there. What it was really doing was showing that their relationship had one person starting to feel like they're doing all the work and the other isn't contributing. The other one lets it stew for a while. Resentment starts to come up. And then one of them finally has enough and just lays it all out on the line. And this was a pretty good lesbian interlude scene. I like this one. And most of the time, like I said, they seem shallow and just kind of pro forma. But this one was pretty powerful and well written and well shot, well acted. Loved it.
This gave them meat to really dig into.
Yeah.
You know, there was work to show that there are very strong flaws in their relationship, especially considering when we had the moment where it was just Dr. David Cameron over their house and they were, you know, finishing each other's sentences. And, you know, it seemed like they just had everything so together that it was a little nauseating.
That was one of those scenes that I just thought was more of the interlude that they had to check the box for that.
Here they feel like a couple in trouble.
Yeah.
Like they felt real finally, mm-hmm. You know, so it's nice that these characters are finally getting something to go after.
Yeah. Back at the big Q. What a great jump from like that very powerful scene to let's go to the big Q and check in on Tracy and Michael.
Right. And so it looks like it's her last day. Mm-hmm. I believe those 2 weeks have passed and she gave in her notice and
to go to the big dollar mart.
Yes. And so, so she's leaving. She's saying goodbye to Mr. Novotny and he goes after her. She really puts him in his place. And I'm like, good for you, Tracy.
She was also defending him though to Marley.
Yes. When she was reading that.
Yeah. So she was objecting to like the way that Mike was being treated and we could see like, okay, this girl's on our side, but then why is she quitting? Just because she couldn't stand to be around Michael, even though she was supportive of him and his sexuality and everything that had happened?
I think because now that there had been such a charade on display at work that to see it fall apart, mm-hmm. You know, and considering the way Marley loves to gossip,
yeah.
She didn't want anything to be a part of that.
Yeah.
And, she secured another job at another big store. You know, why not do that and start afresh? So I get it. But Michael throws out the option, can they still be friends and actually try to be friends with this information.
It kills me that I hurt you, Trace, and I'd do anything to take that back. I know I don't deserve to ask this, but do you think we could still be friends?
Do you think we could be friends?
Emmett, meanwhile, is in the social gym locker room, and Ted is talking about how he's scooping up Brian's leftovers, and he says, "We have symbiosis." And Emmett thinks it's some kind of a condition.
He's like, oh, you can beat it.
Oh, my God. Yeah. You must be strong. Was that for real? Did you think that he really didn't understand the word? Or did he think? What did he think? I didn't get that.
I don't think he knew what it meant.
You're having sex with Brian?
Of course not. We have symbiosis.
Oh, my God. Is there anything they can do? You mustn't give up hope.
I think that was pretty clear. He just didn't know what it meant. And, you know, yes, it's probably a cheap laugh, but it was a laugh nonetheless.
Yeah. I don't know what this whole scene was for other than to have a whole bunch of jock straps and briefs and towels and butts walking around. So,
I'm not hearing a problem.
I think they just had some footage left over that they wanted to get some use out of.
They had some extra 21-page nudity writers and thought, let's just sign these and get this going.
Right. Let's get some extras in here and get their clothes off. So, like most episodes, everything wraps up at Babylon. For whatever reason, this was Black Light Night with undies and big toys.
This was an odd, you know, for all the parties that Babylon has, this was an odd one.
Yeah, and it was made even more odd by the rapid reunification of Brian and Michael.
With that device. Expandable sphere thing that they put on their heads. Sure.
I did like the writing for when they first started talking to each other. That awkward first few moments of reengaging with somebody that you've kind of had a falling out with was captured really well there. So good writing, good acting, good direction. It worked, even though it was in black lights with undies and the expanding toys. But Brian gives Michael good advice about Dr. David as the sphere is collapsing around them and pulling them together. You know, Brian's saying, give him time. That was interesting that Brian would say that. I think he was just happy that Michael was back. And so I think he was just throwing him a little bit of a bone there.
I don't think it's as much that he was throwing him a bone. I think that this was an opportunity for Brian to start allowing Michael gradually back into his life while still making sure that they're keeping the distance to make sure that Michael can be his own person.
Yeah.
So even though Michael may be upset at how Dr. David Cameron handled the business with his stuff, the next scene shows Michael returning. And what is Dr. David Cameron doing?
He put it all back. And he put all the stuff back too.
Not all, but he
engineered the space. Feng shui.
So that they could coexist. That got to me a little. I was...
Oh, oh bless.
It's like he's... It happened, and I literally wrote in all caps in my notes, he's perfect.
Michael was somehow not entirely perfect or true to character here.
He probably had to read Tolstoy and stuff like that.
Michael knows who Leo Tolstoy is. He had never been to the country before, not just two episodes ago. So that was just out of nowhere. And then Dr. David uses even the most rudimentary comic book knowledge about for one day back in whenever Captain Astro had become a woman for the day. That like totally gave Michael a boner and he just pounces on him and the episode ends. I thought that ending was a little bit of a groaner, but Ted was in the coma only slightly longer than Michael and Brian had been broken apart. So it was interesting to have that wrapped up all in one episode.
It was still cute, though. I have nothing else to say other than it was really cute.
So let's recap this one. The question we ask is, does this episode hold up 17 years later? My stock answer is yes, because once again, there wasn't any heavy lifting in a Richard Kramer written episode. The Brian Michael breakup lasted 43 minutes. It gave us some comedy around Ted, some light drama around the lesbians. There's an opportunity for Justin to save the day. It seems a little timeless to me. The one outlier was Emmett seeing the light. That's more rare now, but those things are still around. So it's everything in this episode, I think, could still happen today. How about you, Matt?
I'm sort of like, about the episode. I think the situation with the cohabitation between Michael and Dr. David Cameron is definitely pertinent to couples who are trying to figure out if they can coexist in the same space. The see the light business, that's what started to drag it down for me, because I'm like, we're now in a world where there's so much more acceptance, or at least there's so much more perceived acceptance, that when you hear about these kinds of groups or conversion therapies, that there is such a backlash against them. I'm looking at you, Vice President Mike Pence, you asshole. that there's less, they have less power. Even recently, the Will and Grace revival had an episode where Jack's grandson was taken to one of these places. But it's all done now in a very mocking manner. This tried to treat it with, it tried to validate it, its existence in a way. And so I don't think that really holds up anymore. We now see it and we freely mock it and just make fun of it. And sure, I guess the other thing that kind of helps this episode is that reconnection that happens between old friends. I mean, we've all had those falling outs and what it's like to connect them back together with them and understand your faults and try to work it out. So I'm kind of I think is the best way to describe it.
So there we have episode 12 of season one, Move It or Lose It. Next week, we'll be talking about episode 13, Very Stupid People.
And with episode 13, we're going to get a new director and a new writer on that episode. So I'm looking forward to that one.
Until then, I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Thanks for listening. Leave a like, share with a friend, and subscribe so you don't miss our next episode. Still, Queer as Folk was written and performed by Patrick Randall and Matt Dominguez. Made with love in Chicago.
Hey, Todd, how's it going?
Fine.